I'm Thelma English. We're going to be talking about American literature, and I was going to read the little write-up. American literature, utilizing a survey of American literature from the theism of the Puritans, the deism of the colonists, the transcendentalism of the Alcotts, realism, naturalism, and on into modernism and postmodernism, Thelma will detail the American shifts in religious belief from 1620 to present day. And your handout, you have an incredibly thorough handout there. I am the queen of handouts. And I will spend, 20 hours perfecting a handout, and then year by year I add to it, I go back to it and add, change it around and do all of those things. And so there's a lot of information in this handout. And as you can see in the little write-up in the winter workshop letter here, American literature follows a pattern. We go from one step to the next. And so if you haven't heard it before, this is exactly what we do. We go from theism to deism. There's transcendentalism in there, which also is the introduction of Romanticism. And from then on, once Romanticism is in the picture of American literature, everything changes forever up to present day. And then we get into realism and naturalism, modernism, which is anything anti-traditional, and where we're at now, which is postmodern, and we're entering an area that we don't really have a name for yet. We're trying to decide. It's kind of a conglomeration of everything. For many years now, I've read works, studied worldviews, written curriculum to teach the concepts of Christian worldview literary criticism. These studies have led me to the doorway. Oops, I need this purple piece of paper. I need my little thing. These studies have led me to the doorways of some very important secular and religious thinkers who've participated in what Mortimer Adler calls the Great Conversation. Have you heard of the Great Conversation? Okay, you have all heard of that. The Great Conversation is the conversation through literature that has progressed through all of Western intellectual tradition, transcending the author lifespans, cultures, transcending continents, and even language barriers because we have translation. Each author in the strand is found to be influencing the next author. The Christian presupposition is that this conversation paints a picture of man either in all of his God-reflected glory, we're created in God's image, we're created to reflect his glory, or in all of our shame, what we choose to reflect. Each literary movement represents the greatest thinkers of the time, whether they're Christian or secular. The job of the Christian literature teacher, that's us, is to expose the underlying presuppositions of those great thinkers. We don't read the books just to read the books. And hold them up to the light of biblical truth. Yeah, I have a lot more of these. Maybe put them on the bench up here. The practice of this type of literary criticism is what provides our students with important skills that they'll be able to use for the rest of their reading lives. And more importantly, it'll open up to them the possibility that they could participate in the great conversation. Come on in. There are handouts and purple forms somewhere. Impacting the world for the glory of God. We don't want to just read about and read the great conversation. We want to encourage our kids, participate. Get into that great conversation. Impact the world for Christ. We start out, when we're talking about American literature, right at the top of your handout, and if you don't have a handout, raise your hand and my wonderful husband will get you one. We start out with the Puritanism, with the theism of the Puritans. Puritans, this is the shaping of our national ideals. A study of American literature will begin with the theism of the Puritans. I introduce godly men and women. There are Puritan women who wrote beautiful poetry. It's wonderful because there are men and women, Puritan writers. A secular Puritan focus, what does a secular Puritan focus do when they talk about Puritans in school? What are they going to read? Do you know? Nathaniel Hawthorne, Scarlet Letter. Okay? You're going to read a novel about life in Puritan times. When I teach Puritan literature, And that reinforces Puritan. What do we think of the word Puritan today? We think of it as a negative adjective. It's lost its value in our society. Why not have them read primary source selections from Puritan authors themselves? And then, instead of works about Puritans, and then decide what they think about the Puritans. This is a good time to introduce Calvinism, Wesleyanism. You know, look these things up in a dictionary or on the internet and find out. Once you're saved, can you be unsaved? What do the Wesleyans say? What do the Calvinists say? What do the Puritans say? This is a time to introduce our young people to this. And if you haven't approached that yourself, if that's shocking to you, oh my goodness, you mean once saved, always saved? Or if it's shocking to you to hear you can lose your salvation, if either of those ideas are shocking to you, it's time to look it up and find out and see what what both sides say. You know, if the best theologians can't come to a conclusion on that today, how are we going to do it? But we should know both sides anyway. And this is a good time to do it when we're studying the Puritans. Introduce the great minds of the time. We read selections from William Bradford. He was the governor of Plymouth Plantation. John Smith, I call him the romantic hyperbolic historian because he kind of romanticized everything. He was one of the first romantics. It romanticized everything he wrote. Michael Wigglesworth, oh my goodness. Michael Wigglesworth gets completely ignored in secular society. A brilliant scholar, author of a poem called The Day of Doom. I have a little piece from Michael. This, if you download this from the internet, it will be, 30 or 40 pages long. So I'm just going to read you a little section from The Day of Doom. And secular people really put this down because it's so depressing. So dark and so depressing. Still was the night, serene and bright, when all men sleeping lay. Calm was the season, and carnal reason thought so 'twould last for aye. Soul, take thine ease, let sorrow cease, much good thou hast in store. This was their song, their cups among, the evening before. Wallowing in all kind of sin, vile wretches lay secure. The best of men had scarcely then their lamps kept in good ure. Virgins unwise, who through disguise amongst the best were numbered, had closed their eyes, yea, and the wise, through sloth and frailty slumbered. Like as of old, when men grew bold, God's threatening to contemn, who stopped their ear and would not hear, when mercy warned them. But took their course without remorse till God began to pour destruction the world upon in a tempestuous shower. And we come, do you understand what's going to happen now? This is the day of doom. This is the coming of the Lord. I'm going to skip down and read you, the next section that's best. For at midnight breaks forth a light which turns the night to day, and speedily a hideous cry doth all the world dismay. Sinners awake, their hearts do ache, trembling their loins surpriseth, amazed with fear by what they hear, each one of them ariseth. They rush from beds with giddy heads, and to their windows run, viewing this light which shines more bright than doth the noonday sun. Straightway appears, they see it with tears, the Son of God most dread, who with his train comes on amain to judge both quick and dead. And this goes on for 30 pages. This will give you goosebumps when you read it. Isn't that absolutely beautiful? And of course, secular teachers are going to look at this and say, this is so depressing. You know, when Christ comes back and all these people are going to be divided and you know, the other people are going to go up with Jesus, but these other people, you know where they're going. And so, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Michael Wigglesworth, poetical account of the great last judgment, a work scorned by secular critics for its gloominess and hailed as gripping by surviving theists, you and I. Then read the very religious poetry of Anne Bradstreet. She's on your handout, Anne Bradstreet. Oh my goodness, she wrote the most beautiful poetry. Poems about how much she loved her children and how much she loved her husband and all the hardships that they had gone through. Can you imagine, in the midst of the circumstances of that first 50 years, someone writing poetry? You know, those of you who have ever written poetry, I've only written poetry in the midst of great trials. in the midst of great trials. I've only written just a few. And that's when you write your most profound work, in the midst of great trials. And so you can imagine how beautiful this is. But you can also imagine how this has to be refused by any secular teacher. And so these things we have not been exposed to. You and I didn't see these in school. We don't know about Michael Wigglesworth. We don't know about Anne Bradstreet. Then read a captivity narrative by Mary Rowlandson. It's got a and her restoration. It's about 20 words long, the title. But if you look up on the internet, captivity narrative of Mary Rowlandson, you will find it, and it's absolutely gripping. The Indians attack. Everyone she loves is killed. Her children, her son, she carries with her for days until he dies. There's just a poor expectant woman who's murdered. Her relatives are, you know, it's incredibly gripping, and the way she depends on God through her captivity, and then she is released. And it's absolutely gripping. It's just one of the most beautiful things you'll read. What about a sermon from Jonathan Edwards? Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Secular people really put that one down because they think it's condemning, but it really isn't. It's beautiful. He talks to his congregation as though he were the mother hen, and he's begging them to come back to the flock. It's absolutely beautiful. I read part of his personal narrative, his salvation experience. How about a selection from Cotton Mather? Throw in a few articles from Reformation Today. Someone loaned me a magazine, and it was incredible, on the Puritans. And then let your students decide for themselves what they think about the Puritans. Let them get that positive image of the Puritans. Puritan worldview definitely is providential, theistic. We're looking at these worldviews as they progress from theism to deism and on into Romanticism. And so we want to look at the progression of worldview. We never read a piece of literature just to read a good book. We read that piece of literature to see what does it reflect, what was happening in the world. All of literature before Jesus Christ was pointing to the birth of Jesus Christ, as all of history before Jesus Christ was in preparation for his birth. All of literature since Jesus Christ is in preparation for his return. And so we need to look at what all of literature fits together. All the books we read fit together like a giant patchwork quilt, overlapping one another. And very often we read these pieces out of sequence just for the sake of their literary value. Good characters, let's study these characters and dissect them. We need to study literature with the big picture. We need to be looking at the big quilt, have a big overview of the giant picture of the great conversation, and then look where does this particular piece fall into place. So when we see the Puritans, we realize that these are people, now we don't maybe have a lot of English history, this would be a good time to do a little bit of English history and realize this is also, the Puritans came over 1609 Jamestown, very few of them, they all disappeared, 1620 is what we think of at Plymouth. And what was happening in 1620, well, Shakespeare died 1623, off in England. They were at the beginning, you know, they were into the Renaissance. And so it's a very different world picture that we have what's going on in America. What were Puritans? They wanted to purify the church. They didn't like what was going on in England. They didn't like the worldliness of the church. They wanted to purify themselves. They came over here to get away from that. Generally, when you talk about colonists, if you talk about a place like Australia, you send all the prisoners off there, the colonists, and those were the people that were colonizing. Who were the colonists in America? They were the best educated people in England. These were people who came over here, and in their little log cabins with five families living there, or 10 living there the first year, while Anne Bradstreet wrote her little pieces of poetry about her children and her husband, they were teaching their children very faithfully Greek and Hebrew. These were all Oxford scholars. Most of the Puritans, very few people realize that. That's why this is such an incredible country. I mean, look at our roots. We have these incredible roots. They did not separate religious life from secular life. Yes, you will read stories that if you didn't like it or leave it. It is true. You know, they threw some people out who didn't want to follow the rules and they threw them out. And that's very unpolitically correct today, and it even rubs us usually the wrong way as Christians in America. And what can I say? People are going to look back at us and see many of the things we do, and they're going to rub them the wrong way, see what we let happen under our very noses. Knowledge comes from grace. I told you most of them were educated at Oxford or Cambridge. Social view, this was not a democracy. This was a theocracy. That's why if you didn't like it, you had to leave. This was not a democracy. It was a theocracy. Isn't that fascinating? That's a good word to look up. They considered themselves to be the new Israelites in the Promised Land. Now, they came over in 1620. 1660, I think, was when John Milton wrote Paradise Lost over in England. And what was Paradise Lost? That was Adam and Eve losing their paradise, but it was also a political piece. What had England just lost? From 1649 to 1660, we call that period of English history the interregnum. I can't pronounce it right. I can't remember the pronunciation. The 11 years that they went without a monarch. And John Milton is lamenting their paradise lost. When they said, no, we want a king. We have to have a king. And they had their opportunity to live without a king, and they blew it. And that was the purpose of Paradise Lost. And that's the time period that these people were leaving and coming over here. So if we stand back and look at the huge, big world picture, things make a lot more sense. The lives of the Puritans, the type of people that came here, make a lot more sense. Religious, they were very conscientious people of prayer. Once you begin reading their works rather than works written about them or stories written about Puritans and pilgrims, you will realize they believed very solidly in original sin, depravity of man, salvation by grace. Definitely, you would not have any theological problems with any of their basic foundational theology. They might have problems with some of our rather loose theology. Positively a literal Genesis creation, but some of them were a little bit naturalists. Anne Bradstreet will admire the beauty of nature in the midst of trying to survive. You know, she will admire the beauty of nature. View of history, very much like, I think this is fascinating, very much like Francis Schaeffer. Their view of history seems to be like Francis Schaeffer. There's the seen and the unseen. What's here is just the seen. If you could see what was going on in the heavens, if you could see God's big plan instead of your one little tiny piece of the puzzle, you would be content and rest easy even in the midst of your harsh circumstances. Even though your 3 out of 5 children died last winter and your husband died, and, you know, they're 2 men whose wives died, and you're going to have to marry one of them to survive. In the midst of those circumstances, they're going to accept that this is God's providential will for them. Very much the seen and the unseen world. They believe we just can't see it. If we could see what was going on, we would accept it gratefully. I enjoy their view of history. Representative works and persons, we've talked about quite a few of those. You've got a list. Other topics and works to introduce, you definitely would want to download a copy of the Mayflower Compact. It's a 1-page document just to read what they agreed on before they got off the boat. Read some Native American tribal histories. I realize that what's gone on here, especially after the Columbus 500-year anniversary, a lot of Columbus bashing, saying we should not be here, that the whites came and stole the country. Very much, if you're reading the literature, if you read much about the natives, you will realize it was very providential. Now, I'm sorry if you're native. I'm part native, so I can say this. You know, it was providential. This was God's place for us. We were meant to be here, not just natives. I mean, we were meant to come here. This was a place that we were meant to come. We move into colonialism, and our worldview, we have a shift. Now, you can't take 1 year and say we shifted this year. There are these overlaps. And you gradually move from one thing until you realize, oh my goodness, we are not theistic anymore. We are deistic. You can look all of these things up in an encyclopedia. I believe I've put footnotes. Yes, I have. I've put endnotes by all of the major terms so that if you get back to page 4, you have half a page of footnotes with just very brief 2 or 3 one-sentence explanations of theism, empiricism, enlightenment, deism, romanticism, all of those. And then you can look them up on your own. The first 4 pages of your handout is my outline going from worldview to worldview. The last 4 pages, and it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, the last 4 pages are a timetable of American history and literature, just to kind of help you see where the pieces fit in time with some little historical things thrown in. I mentioned to those that came early, I'm kind of the queen of handouts. I love making handouts, and usually my handouts have little bits of clip art and things like that on them. I get carried away with handouts. And footnotes, I'm the queen of footnotes and endnotes, little trivial pieces of information. But I hope this will help you. One of the most valuable resources, and unfortunately they're expensive, is this book. If you're going to study American literature and you're going to do it with several children, or you just want, just for your own reading, this is the Oxford Companion to American Literature. The only problem is I think it's somewhere between $40 and $60, probably. I know Eli at Exodus asked me which books I would be recommending today, and I told him this one, and he never did respond. I suppose he's very disappointed. Oh, did it have to be something so expensive? But this is the only thing you buy. You look up deism in here. You look up Bradford. You look up anything about American literature, and it's going to be in here. And so I bought mine on the net. I bought mine used for $49. Okay, so I'd go on the net and see what you can find used. You can find any author in here, even characters. So if you say, oh, who was Natty Bumppo? You can look it up in here and say, oh, James Fenimore Cooper, that's right, okay. And it's got a little timeline in the back so that if you have no idea who was writing when or what they wrote, you have no idea at all. And my timeline is just 4 little pages. There are lots of historical information with a timeline type, a timetable type sequence in the back of this. So even though this is an expensive book, I'd buy one because you're going to use this for the rest of your reading life. Anytime you read a piece of American literature, you want to read about that person. This will give you the author, the little author biography, the character biography. This will tell you, is Natty Bumppo in more than one book? You know, by James Fenimore Cooper. Oh, he's a serial character. Look at that. So you can look up all types of things in this book. And another book, I hesitated to bring this, but you don't want to just hear how smart and professional and everything I am. You want to hear, like, how desperate I am, right? Because aren't we all in the same boat as homeschool moms? I don't know why they put such awful covers and titles on these books, but this is The Complete Idiot's Guide to American Literature. And about the first 90% of it is very valuable. The last 10% gets multicultural and jumps into stuff I would never read. But the first 90% of it is very valuable. It's very easy to read definitions on realism and naturalism. And, oh, by the way, you know, Hemingway couldn't take it anymore. And at age 60, when he couldn't be the He-Man, macho He-Man, he wanted to be committed suicide. That's really important to know when we read Hemingway, that, oh my goodness, when he couldn't live up to that literary ideal anymore, he could not deal graciously with getting older and committed suicide like his father. And so it's really important for us to know all of that information. And so this gives you all types of little pieces of information on realism, naturalism, who was writing what. It's not going to be as professional as this, but this is also very inexpensive. Okay, this said $16.95, but I know anything you buy at Barnes & Noble is 20% off. And so this is worth getting. Another resource, you don't have to have this one. This is called A Handbook to Literature. And if you go in any major bookstore and just say, I need a handbook to literature, it's a dictionary of literary terms. And this you can pick up used at Powell's. It doesn't matter who printed it. This happens to be the Harper Handbook to Literature. I picked it up because Northrop Frye was one of the editors, and I recognized his name. He's a Christian literary critic, and so I knew, you know, but I don't think it really makes any difference. But I can look up alphabetically apology. What's an apology? What is apposition? What is deconstruction? What is imitation? What is immaculate conception? Oh, they've even got that in here. Frequently mistaken. Okay, we all know that. What is mood? What is a motif? What are the muckrakers? What is Old English versification? And it's going to show you what is parallelism. These are just literary terms that if you want to have your own little literary circle or understand what some of those terms are, this is just literary terms. And my guess is that you could pick up one of these for under $15, just a paperback handbook to literature, anybody's. These you may have seen before, Reading Between the Lines by Jean Edward Vaith. He does a lot of literary criticism. I know in seminary we read some of his books. Reading Between the Lines, A Christian Guide to Literature. This is really good because he's the one who pointed out, I love his phrase, he said that when we as Christians are offended by literature, it is because it has either trivialized or profaned something that we hold to be sacred. I never forgot that. I use that repeatedly. We know when we're offended. But to try and put it into words, when you try and watch a movie, I get up all the time. We don't watch TV anymore, but occasionally we'll rent a movie, and we have a television in the upstairs, and we'll rent a movie, and I think, I don't know, how often do I get up and walk out of a movie? 1 out of 4? 1 out of 3? I get up and leave. I have better things. If they profane something I hold to be sacred, I don't care if they don't show a lot of skin. If this couple is obviously living together, I really could care less what happens to them in this movie. I have no interest in their story. I'm out of there. I have better things to do. They have profaned something I hold to be sacred, and I refuse to see that trivialized. That was the best line I got out of here. I'm sure that's from Edward Vaith, and I've never forgotten that. And then this is great, The Discerning Reader. And this is Leland Reichand, who also, we use him in seminary. We use his books. Leland Reichand, we use him in seminary, his other books. This is called The Discerning Reader, Christian Perspectives on Literature and Theory. And it's a very similar book to the Vaith book in that he goes through Paradise Lost, Shakespeare and Christianity, the Bible and Literary Study, The Woman's Place, The Turn to History, all types of fascinating chapters. So if you have time, How Feminist Can a Handmaid Be? That's one of the chapters. That's a good one. Why Wait for an Angel? For further reading, a survey, and tons of good notes. And so this, if you're just interested in literary criticism, why do we read the books we read? This is really a good one. Okay, those are the recommended resources. We're going to get back to colonialism now, deism. And this is our next major step in philosophy. And I call this the American Enlightenment. We're always about 20 years behind Europe. It hits Europe first, and then it comes over here. Romanticism was the same way. We picked it up from our mama over there. We picked it up from Europe. These are our democratic origins. These are the revolutionary writers. And this is the Puritan giving way to the Yankee. I got that term from this book, The Puritan Gives Way to the Yankee. I really liked that. I thought, yes, that reflects exactly what happened. And one thing that I meant to put right after the word Yankee was common sense. This becomes the age of common sense. So right after The Puritan Gives Way to the Yankee, you can just add common sense. This is the age of common sense. The colonists introduced the next generations of Americans. These are the men who shaped our foundational documents with a worldview very different from their grandparents. These men, in rebellion and in arrogance, and they were great men, rejected the established theism of the previous 1700 years. Do you realize that? Theism was the worldview for 1700 years. And they rejected this for this impersonal, deistic belief. They rejected the pleas of Jonathan Edwards, and he pleads with them. If you start reading Jonathan Edwards, realize he's pleading to these grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Please come back. Come back to the God of your fathers. to return to God and embrace, and rather than return to God as a personal father, they embrace the clockwork universe model. That's what deism is. But the American experiment was a success. The intellectual Puritans, and I told you almost all of them graduated either from Oxford or Cambridge. Almost all of the first Puritans coming over. They had survived against all odds. Their combined spiritual genius lay in the fact that they were men of prayer. Imagine, surprise, surprise. Theology was not an academic exercise for them. It was the practical application of biblical truth. Their success bred confidence in their children, and the pioneer spirit was continued. That's what America's known for. We have the pioneer spirit. West. Move west. Go west. We're the people of that pioneer spirit, and that's from the Puritans. Men discontinued teaching Greek and Hebrew to their children, as many of the Puritans had, and began looking, if we don't want what our grandma and grandpa have, where shall we look? Europe. What does Europe have? It always looks better on the other side, doesn't it? If you're going to reject what dad and what grandma and grandpa have, let's look to somebody whose culture has been around for a lot longer. They just look a lot smarter. The government that would emerge would be a democracy, not a theocracy. We still have the best government system in the world. I cannot think of a country I would rather live in. But this is not a theocracy. This is a democracy. Fueled by writings like Rutherford's Lex Rex, you can look it up on the net, the British colonists weakened in their loyalty and challenged the divine right of kings. Okay, they started thinking, maybe the king doesn't have the divine right to rule, especially if he makes a contract with us and doesn't keep his part of the contract. Growing discontent over failed promises, taxes without representation, and broken charters led thinkers like Tom and Paine to suggest common sense. Your kids have to read Common Sense. And the war for independence was looming in the future. I prefer to refer to our war as the war for independence, because if you call it the Revolutionary War, you are associating just a little too much with the French Revolution, because they're very much in the same time period. But the French Revolution was very much one of anarchy, and the American Revolution was a war for independence. We had contracts were broken. We were challenging the divine right of kings. We had that right. And so to disassociate with the French Revolution, I prefer to use the term the war for independence. I have given you knowledge, Lockean empiricism. If you don't know who John Locke was, you're going to look him up now. Empiricism, you've got a small explanation in your end notes. Global expansion, discovery. We have the American Enlightenment. Three characteristics of the Enlightenment. Emphasis on reason. Okay, the age of reason. Skepticism toward all traditions. This is going to get more and more severe as we progress through time. Reason, anti-tradition, and the belief in the progression of mankind. Once we discount depravity of man, original sin, then we look at progression of man. Our worldview changes, and we go to the opposite spectrum, and we say, men are getting better. We just need to make our world better. We are progressing. We are getting better. We're getting smarter and more intellectual. Anti-tradition. Rather than holding to the traditions of your fathers, we're getting anti-traditional. And this is going to get more and more extreme. This is the first step away, and we're going to see this magnified each step as we go through our worldviews progressing. It's going to get worse and worse. Once you turn your back away from God, there's going to be a dependence on reason. We're going to elevate anything anti-traditional, and we're going to believe in the progression of mankind. This is the beginning of the end. Only we can change things. Our kids are changing things. I'm going to read you something from Voltaire, from his Penzies, and this is quite a quote. This is an Enlightenment quote. What a light has burst over Europe within the last few years. It first illuminated all the princes of the north. It's even come into the universities. It's the light of common sense. That's the Enlightenment. Common sense. We don't have to do this because you're doing that because your father told you to do that. Reason it out for yourself. Figure it out for yourself. You're just following this because it's traditional. You're only following this because you think you're born in sin. And you can see those three things. Once you reject those three things, those Enlightenment tenets, biblical tenets, you see the Enlightenment as the introduction to the rest of the worldviews. The seeds of Romanticism, which would destroy much of the Judeo-Christian culture of America over the next 200 years, were sown. And so this is deism, the clockwork universe. God is the celestial watchmaker. He made the world and then stepped away. He's just not watching. He's not looking anymore. The Great Awakenings. Do you know why we had these? The Great Awakening? Now it fits in, doesn't it? These are the last of the Puritans begging people to stay, begging them to come back. Please don't go the way you're going. Please stay. And it was too late. Jonathan Edwards was our precursor to Billy Graham, you know, going all over on his horse and trying to get people. George Whitefield. I know that Benjamin Franklin said that when he went to listen to George Whitefield, his friend, when he went to listen to him preach, he never took money with him because he didn't want to give any money, and he knew that once he got there, he would want to give. And so he didn't take money with him because he knew it would be so effective. He'd want to give for the gospel, give for the cause. I think that's fascinating. That tells us a little bit about Benjamin Franklin. The social view, I think we have a good picture of that. Self-concept, I think we've got a good picture of that. Creation, deism is going to look at creation as very mechanical. It works because of the laws of nature. Therefore, we need to develop science more fully so that we understand the way it works more. So we need to establish new fields and areas of science to discover the way that the world works. We see a hierarchical separation of God, man, and nature, rather than looking at God as the hand that created and moves. We see a separation now. Separation. God created the earth and walked away. And we begin to see nature with the capital N. This is the beginning of nature with the capital N. Representative persons and works for deism. Obviously, Benjamin Franklin, his autobiography is fascinating. His 13th virtue was imitate Jesus and Socrates. That says a lot, doesn't it? Thomas Jefferson. Oh my goodness, you could read his. They just printed the Jefferson Bible now, and they took out all the miracles. What else did they take out? He was quite a man. Worth reading. William Blackstone, Early American Law, John Locke. You can look these up just in your encyclopedia and read one paragraph about them and make a little note just so that you know who they are before you start reading Benjamin Franklin's autobiography or something. Now we come into Romanticism, and this is the beginning. You know, now we're here. We're on the downward slide. Romanticism, I call this biblical principles turned upside down. My friend from Southern Adventist University, Dr. Haluska, who teaches literature there in much the same way that I teach literature and has helped me out really quite a bit, he calls this a revolution of the hierarchy conception. For the first 1700 years, the hierarchy conception, have you ever heard of that, the hierarchy conception? Okay, you've got God at the top. Now, if you're Catholic, right under God is probably Mary, you know, then the angel, then Jesus, then the angels, then the Pope, then all the other important people, bishops and people like that. And then you're going to get down to men, and then women, and then children, and then animals are under people, plants are under animals, and then the earth. Okay, that's the hierarchy. And man, if you read anything about medieval thought, man is kind of the connector between heaven and earth. Man is part of both. He's created to live in heaven, but he is on earth. He's going to go to heaven but he has to live out on earth first. And man is the link in the great chain of being. Man is that link. If you've ever heard any of these terms, if you hear them again now, they'll mean something to you. Well, with Romanticism, okay, if we had earth at the bottom and God on top, and I say there was a revolution of the hierarchy conception, what have we seen happen in the last 205 years? Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolute flip-flop. Complete flip-flop. You can look, if you do any medieval history, eventually you'll find some cute little picture of the hierarchy conception. And it'll look like a tree or branches or a chain or something. And you can see who fit in where. They knew who was above you, who was below you. Where did you fit in this great chain of being? And you can see that picture. And then visualize in your mind now, flip-flopping that, and you'll see that's exactly where we're at. Absolutely where we're at today. This is Romanticism. So we want to represent Romanticism clearly. Let's see, I want to use my time wisely too. Our culture is so steeped in it that it has become a large part. It's the norm. It's the norm here. You and I are romantic. We don't want to be, but we are. Most teens don't even understand it, let alone recognize it. Most parents don't understand it. They think it's something between a boy and a girl. They don't realize what Romanticism is. Most of the parents of my students don't know what it is. They wonder what I'm teaching when I teach Romanticism. You know, about 25% of the parents don't understand what Romanticism is. They may realize some aspects of our culture offend their Christian sensibilities, but they don't know why. My worldview compels me, you know, open our eyes to the dangers of Romanticism. Romanticism trivializes or profanes something that we as Christians hold to be sacred. Romanticism trivializes or profanes something that we as Christians hold to be sacred. Thus, we are offended. Logic and common sense had been the impetus for revolution in France and independence in America. Revolution in France, independence in America. We became independent. We didn't have anarchy. We became independent. Theistic concepts and traditions had faded with each successive generation. Neoclassicism, the re-interest in Greek and Roman things. You know, what does all the architecture in Washington, D.C. look like? Greek and Roman stuff. Right? It's all classical architecture. There was new classicism. That interest had kind of died off. It came, it was there for a while. Jefferson built everything like that. You know, they really liked the architecture of the Greeks and the Romans, and they utilized that for a while. They were very interested in the Greek and Roman things. That died off. The Enlightenment, which glorified human reason, okay, human reason, common sense, was fading. Now, with the Industrial Revolution, a new sympathy for the poor is aroused. This is a big part of Romanticism. The English notions of Romanticism made their way across the sea into the open, seeking minds of the Americans. We were about 20 years behind them. 40. Romanticism, if you wanted a specific date, you could actually say 1798. That is when the English William Wordsworth published his lyrical ballads, specifically Tintern Abbey. I have a little something from William Wordsworth to read to you. I hope. Oh, I put him in my little English thing because he's not American. Here he is. Just so that you get a taste of what Romanticism is. This is from a poem called The Tables Turned. Up, up, my friend, and quit your books, or surely you'll grow double. Up, up, my friend, and clear your looks. Why all this toil and trouble? The sun above the mountain's head, a freshening luster mellow, through all the long green fields has spread his first sweet evening yellow. Books! 'Tis a dull and endless strife. Come, hear the woodland linnet, how sweet his music. On my life, there's more of wisdom in it. And hark, how bliss the throstle sings. He too is no mean preacher. Come forth into the light of things. Let nature be your teacher. Here's nature. Now nature is personified. She has a world of ready wealth, our minds and hearts to bless. All right, she's our new spirituality. Nature is. our replacement for God. Spontaneous wisdom breathed by health, truth breathed by cheerfulness. One impulse from a vernal wood may teach you more of man, of moral evil, and of good than all the sages can. Sweet is the lore which nature, capital N, brings. Our meddling intellect misshapes the beauteous forms of things we murder to dissect. Enough of science and of art. Close up those barren leaves, books. Come forth and bring with you a heart that watches and receives. This is romanticism. Okay, we can learn more than nature from the preachers and the books and art and science. Romanticism is very dependent on emotional impressions and feelings. Very dependent. This is something from the Rousseau's Confessions, and he's also English, but I'm going to read it because he influenced Romanticism in America. I am commencing an undertaking hitherto without precedent and which will never find an imitator. I desire to set before my fellow men the likeness of a man in all the truth of nature. This is what he's going to write. Okay? He's going to set forth the likeness of a man. And that man is myself, myself alone. I know the feelings of my heart, and I know men. I'm not made like any of those I've seen. I venture to believe that I'm not made like any of those who are in existence. This is romanticism at its core. It's all about me and how I feel and my experiences. Revolution of the hierarchy. This is it. Knowledge is based on aspire to be great, be inspired from nature with the capital N, scientific rationalism, figure things out scientifically for yourself. The worldview definitely is individualistic. You only know through your own mind. Everything is very self-focused. Blind obedience to a defined truth such as the Bible or a moral absolute would be completely rejected. But we didn't see the moral anarchy that we had in Europe. Europe was much worse off from Romanticism. They were way ahead of us. Social view, autocracy of the soul, definitely. Man is controlling his own fate. You are what you make yourself to be. Does that sound familiar? Do all these things sound familiar? Yeah, this is where we're at. We're at the extremes of this. We're at the very end of this. Self-concept. Or religious. Focus on individual. Discover yourself. You know, you deserve a break. Take care of yourself. Progression of mankind. It's only going to get better. What can we leave? How can we leave the world for our children? Creation, very much organic. You know, this exploded. This happened. These two things mixed together. These protozoa, you know, crawled out. There they are. So a little bit pantheistic. History, very much a natural, very much in opposition to a providential view. History, well, this happened because this happened. This happened because this happened. These things linked up, this happened. It wasn't a plan, and these people were supernaturally used in the providential plan. These things just happened. Representative authors and works. Emerson, Hawthorne, read biographies on these men. You can read biographies on them in here. If you do searches on the net, Emerson, you know, plus Christianity or something, you can get some Christian literary criticism. And some of these guys in the early romantics in America were absolutely fascinating. You know, we lift up Henry David Thoreau. And yes, we should read The Introduction to Walden or some part of Walden, but don't spend 2 months reading that. We should read that, but also read some biography on him and realize that while he was living at Walden during the work to write all of this wonderfully poetic journal, that on the weekends he went into town to drink and carouse. You know, you need to be up on it. Now, I realize today we're into deconstruction and they say the author has nothing to do with the book anymore. It's what it means to you. That's not Christian literary criticism, people. We need to know about the authors. We need to understand. We need to know these people that committed suicide. That makes a difference, doesn't it? Their worldview, the things that they wrote, are very definitely probably going to be nihilistic. A free press and the addition of inexpensive magazines to our nation's printed resources spread ideas easily and quickly to the masses. Philosophers and theologians were no longer the only men engaging in the deeper questions of life. Poets and writers of novels were changing the way people thought. Now it's not just the intellectual people experiencing the changing thought. When you get mass literature production and cheap literature out there, you can change the way people think. It's very much like television today. If you see it on TV often enough, it's not going to look so bad to you anymore after a while. You're going to be so desensitized that you will not even recognize it after a few years. Truth and beauty were seen to emanate from the human heart. As Shelley wrote in 1821, poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. Poets, people, common people will read poetry. What I read you from Wordsworth, your throw away the books, go to the brooks. You know, it's better than a preacher's sermon. Doesn't that sound beautiful? On a beautiful spring day, doesn't that just sound wonderful? It really does. You have something inside you that answers to that. And that's what happened. It was now a fully human world that had turned its back on the Creator. If you have the big quilt and you've got theism, deism, then Romanticism is this big thing, and everything from here on out is under and hooked to Romanticism. Everything else has roots to Romanticism from here on out. Transcendentalism was this little tiny piece of the puzzle. Little tiny piece. But it's worth looking at, especially because Louisa May wrote such beautiful books. Little Women, Little Men. And once you read a little bit about transcendentalism, read the tenets of transcendentalism here. These are senses. It combines a world of senses, sensory feeling, with a world that transcends the senses. Okay, you're going to experience these things that transcend. Spirituality without the Holy Spirit. Okay, communing without God, with yourself or nature. If you read, for example, Little Men. We have read that 3 or 4 times. I love that book, and I have little men. I have 2 boys. And so we love that book, and there's some wonderful things. However, that's a good book to talk about transcendentalism because it definitely displays the idea that, let's read some of those. Thrilling delight in nature. Remember, she keeps a little journal on each boy that she talks about them each week. These boys are not living with their own families because some are intellectually superior. There's a strong need of intellectual companionship. There is intense individualism. Let's see. I want to find. I didn't put that on. Transcendentalism, one of the tenets also, was definitely that the intellectuals are the ones who deserve to be the ruling, to be in charge. And somehow that's not on your handout. But you'll see that in Little Men. That's why those boys are not in their homes. It's because Joe is better. Joe and Father Bear are better educated and better parents than these other children's parents are. Why do those kids live with them? Why aren't they living with their own parents? You know, you ever think about that? Why are they living with Joe and Father Bear? For all their school, they don't just go there for school every day. They live there. They're growing up there because these parents are better educated and better suited for parenting, and so they should be the parents, and so they take in kids from all over to try to nourish society in that way. Romanticism, 1830s to present. Like I said, if you wanted a birth of Romanticism, you'd say 1798. That's William Wordsworth, the lyrical ballads. Sensibility, follow your heart, it will never lie. Revolution of all propriety, you reject everything traditional or absolute. Innocence replaces wisdom. Okay, let's go out, you can learn more from the brooks and from the sky than from books. The green concept, nature over civilization. Civilization is what has ruined you. Often set, you know what a romantic setting is. It's going to be in the distant, in the future, some pastoral setting, some beautiful place. That's very common. Imagination's going to replace reality. This is where we have in the importance of intuition. What do you think about that? Follow your heart. That's how you'll know. Occult fantasies. Now we have an introduction of books like Frankenstein and Dracula, things that cannot be in God's natural world. Now we have the an introduction of these things, occult fantasies. Elevation of the noble savage image. Civilization is to blame for man's problems. Freud will eventually, another few years, will write The Civilization and Its Discontents, telling how civilization, and in particular Christianity, has ruined people. And if we could just root out Christianity, we could fix all the people, because they wouldn't feel so guilty and they wouldn't be so messed up. Does that sound familiar? Representative authors are going to be Hawthorne, Poe, Thoreau, Melville, Whitman, Cooper. Easy. If you have a book like this, you can look up Romanticism, and it's going to tell you representative authors. Slavery accounts and slave narratives. Read at least one so you feel it. We don't have anybody in here who's probably ever been discriminated against. We do not have any idea what it is like to be so black that we don't think we're prejudiced, do we? None of us think we're prejudiced. But can you imagine walking into a room and you are so dark that you stick out like a sore thumb? It's still happening here in America. And the only way for us to fight against that, to not be... Now, here in the Northwest, we don't have enough black people to even practice on not being hypocritical, not being... What's the word? Prejudice, not being prejudiced. But if you want to really know what it was like to be black during the time of slavery, read a slave narrative. Your children should read one of those. Now, I don't know whether you think reparation is right or not, giving black people now extra advantages because they're black to make up for their grandparents and great-grandparents. I wouldn't pretend to address that. But our kids need to realize that it was not always like it is today. And if you read something like Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, oh my goodness, that can be a life-changing book. Uncle Tom is definitely a Christ type in literature. He will sacrifice his life gladly for others, black or white. An incredible book, but you'll cry, I guarantee you, or we did anyway. Southwestern humor and local color and regionalism. This is something you need to know exists. The best representative authors, of course, is going to be Mark Twain, reading something like Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, definitely making fun of religion. Huckleberry Finn really makes fun of the religious people, makes fun of religion. All the religious people there are hypocrites. Guess what Samuel Clemens thought about Christianity? After his daughter died at a very young age, he was never the same. If you read some of his essays on God, oh my goodness, he was a very sorry, sorry man. They're wonderful books to read, but this is the time to discuss with your children. Do you see how apparently the people have become so many of the Christians he was in contact apparently were such pathetic examples of Christians that he simply assumed all of Christianity was were hypocrites, and so he made fun of them, parodied them in his books. Realism. Life is short and then you die. That's from this book. That's one line from this book. I liked that because that's realism in a nutshell. This continues today. We have the loss of the literary hero now. There are no more heroes to imitate, are there? You know, we don't see movies or books where you have this idealistic hero, bigger and better and truer than life, for our children to imitate. They're gone. Everything is realistic now. That's part of Romanticism. Romanticism was not able to fulfill the wars turned, look at the time period here, after the Civil War. The wars turned optimism into a growing cynicism in literary America. The focus now became entirely void of any theistic remnants due to the stark reality of the post-war conditions. In 1860, most Americans lived on farms or in small villages. By 1919, half of the population was concentrated in 12 major cities across the continent. Major upheaval in our way of life. Our little debtor nation had become a strong economic force. By 1914, now this is pre-World War I, the world's wealthiest, we were the world's wealthiest, and we were the major world power. Realism, a strong force in literature, grew to dominance with Samuel Clemens, Henry James, John Steinbeck. Don't read any of the novels. John Steinbeck, read The Red Pony. There's realism. I got my copy from Annette, and it's a short story. That's John Steinbeck without reading the novel. Read a short story. All of these authors scout around for the short stories they've written rather than reading their full-length novels, and that way you can concentrate on other Christian literature written that does not follow this pattern, written during the same time period. But you're going to have to read this stuff to illustrate to your children this progression. Realism paints the stark reality of bare life without God, without hope of redemption. Some have strong characters who survive against the odds. Think of The Call of the Wild. The nice guy dies. The dog who fights wins. The man, very animalistic traits. Very animalistic. Naturalism. What's the next natural step after realism? Naturalism. We are just progressing downhill. Now we see, from realism, it was a natural progression to naturalism. The social Darwinism, remember Darwin? Okay, if you believe that blacks are only two-thirds human, wait till you read what Darwin said about women. I read to my Lit Circle kids, I put one or two pages of what Darwin said about women, and they just are incensed, even as Christians. You know, they're not feminists, they're just incensed. Because if blacks are not fully human, what do you think women are, okay? Women, you know, have smaller brains, smaller everything, according to Darwin and his school. And this is Darwinistic, social Darwinism is what we call this. You know, it's okay to have a slave because he's not really fully developed. All men did not come from Adam and Eve, okay? They came up from other slime here and there, and they're not as fully developed as we are, and women are weaker and not as developed. Therefore, the women are to be used, and the blacks are to be used. They can't live on their own because they're still part animal. And so doesn't that stroke your conscience if you're a slave owner in the South? Isn't that ugly? The influence of Freud, Marx, and Nietzsche cannot be overestimated. Read at least a magazine article on those guys. From naturalism, we go into modernism. Anything in modernism is simply hodgepodge of everything else, pieces of everything else we've discussed. Anything anti-traditional. If it's traditional, you reject it. What's the next natural step past modernism? Postmodernism, where we're at today. This is T.S. Eliot. Endless invention, endless experiment brings knowledge of motion, but not of stillness. Knowledge of speech, but not of silence. Knowledge of words and ignorance of the word, capital W. All our knowledge brings us nearer to death. By nearer to death, no nearer to God. Where's the life we've lost in living? Where's the knowledge we've lost in information? That's The Rock by T.S. Eliot. And then Kurt Vonnegut, excellent example of postmodernism. What is literature but an insider's newsletter about affairs relating to molecules of no importance to anything in the universe but a few molecules who have the disease called thought? That's us. Have I painted a pretty good picture? Your handout has information. Your handout has enough information to go for about a four-hour session. And obviously we don't have that many hours, but I've tried to give you many more details than what we could go through in the hour. Do you have the picture painted of that big picture? Okay. Thank you very much. My website, www.thelmaslibrary.com. It's at the bottom of all the handouts. If you go to that website, you can contact me and get email enclosures of the handouts from today or more information. Thank you very much. The Lord bless you.